Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody's got the fever. This is something we all know. Fever isn't such a new thing. Fever started long ago. Never know how much I love you. You never know how much I care. When you put your arms around me, I get a feeling that's too hard to bear. You give me fever.
Well, that's enough of that. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Lenny Godfrey's Straight No Chaser. Thank you so much for tuning in this evening, everyone. The numbers are popping on, so thank you very much for tuning in. You know that this is the time that I do a little bit of housekeeping right after the music, and we have some wonderful guests for our panel tonight in this subject of education and the arts. So let me do all of the housekeeping first, so then we can get to them a little bit later, and I can savor the introductions that I have prepared for them. Now, the first thing is that you are listening to blogtalkradio.com/ S is in Sam, F is in Fred, T is in Tom, H is in Harry, and the number 2. If you want to dial in and you are listening from the website, you can dial in at 516-453-6063. Put a 1 in front of that, so that would be 1-516-453-6063. We have now been doing this for over 2 years, and there are over 100 episodes. Mostly public. I think there are 3 or 4 that are not. There were tests. So you can go back at that website, blogtalkradio.com/SFTH2, and hear anything that you've missed over time. They have archived that for me. And then if you want to see what we do afterwards, we do a webinar, which is called the After Show Afterthoughts. And in the After Show Afterthoughts, we continue to talk about some of the things that we've talked about for an hour here, but we give the audience an opportunity to look and see at the people that they've been listening to for an hour. And sometimes people actually look at that first because it appears on YouTube, on my channel, Lenny Godfrey channel. It appears on Facebook, on both of my pages. And you can see the people, you can get a preview of what is going to be talked about, who is saying it, and then you can go and listen to at Blog Talk Radio. So that's a lot of the process that happens. Some people do it from here and go to the video. Some people do the video, wait, and do the video because they're occupied from 7 to 8 p.m. But anyway, we've been doing this for a while, and I thank you all so much for continually listening in and bringing your energy and your good vibes. And tonight's conversation should be very interesting. Let me tell you why I came up with this. It was not scheduled initially at the beginning of the season, but I was looking at television not too long ago, and my husband likes a lot of the programs that have the judges. And I was standing there listening in one particular program. There was a case in which a young teacher had discovered that her student had been cheating and approached the parent about it. This happened to be the mother. And the mother was not overly excited about it. The program that this child was in was a math program in the summertime. It was very expensive. It was a couple of $1,000s. And but all of these participants are Black Americans. So she thought, well, you know, maybe there's been a mistake. I won't pursue this. But the teacher came back to her again and after a while and said, yes, she's done this one thing again. And the parents said, yes. Well, I want some proof. The teacher went on to take a snapshot of this young child. The child, I believe, was 8 or 9 years old. And it showed that she had written something in her hand. Then she presented it to the parents. Now, I don't know in what generation we're listening to now, but in the generation that I belong to, the greatest humiliation that can happen in your school experience is when your parent has been told something or has been called to school. There's no greater humiliation. Even your peers can't match that because therefore your family name has been put into jeopardy and you represent your family. So I think, you know, that I think that was the end of the exercise, but it wasn't because the young teacher, and she was, what, 27, 28 years old, decided that she wanted to have a teaching moment. And the teaching moment was that she decided that she would take this photograph and put it on social media. And the effect, of course, was devastating to this student because not only had she embarrassed her family privately, that, you know, then her family had been publicly embarrassed as she was, and then so many people all over the world understood this. So my conversation is, where are we with the usage of social media? Where are we, and what are we teaching our children about it, and what are the teachers thinking about it? And I have in this panel tonight brought to you two people who I know very well professionally. Both of them are Broadway performers, but they have extensive education experience. I want to start with Diane Wilson, who is, if you look, first of all, her performance experience, if you look at any album, you know, behind any major recording artist, you will see Diane's name, and I'm very proud to call her my friend. She has an extensive background in the studio. She's a great vocalist, but also what she is a great teacher because she's taught in the public schools for 31 years. She also taught the Boys Harbor for 30 years. Then she's taught private vocals. She's taught the performing arts. She's been a musical director for theater productions. She taught at the New School College for a social research a semester. She taught music therapy and choir harmony. Now, I don't know about any of you. I mean, none of you are not musical, then these things sound like, well, of course, you know, she's a musical person. But those of us who are music understand what, you know, harmony, theory, all of those things. To be able to just master it is one thing. To be able to be good enough to teach it is a whole other thing. So with that, I will say to Diane to say hello to the audience and letting her know that I am in awe of her gifts. Not only is that, but as an arranger, as a composer, as a writer, as an educator, and an experienced educator for many, many years. So, Diane, please say hello to the audience.
Hello, everyone. Glad to be here. This is a topic that is very dear to me, and I can't wait to get started talking about it because the missed opportunities is what comes to mind when it comes to educating children. There's so much going on with families that starts the ball rolling, and a lot of dysfunctional situations I have experienced. I've experienced parents, and it passes down to the children. So they come already, you know, with baggage and lots of issues. Then you get into the school who are, and they're the teach. Everybody's trying to impress the principals, which I have to say that was not top on my list. A lot of people felt that that was wrong. I totally right. It was about the children. And they're under pressure as well, though. Everybody has someone to answer to. And when it's not working, people do resort. I've heard stories about cheaters, you know, and I can't say personally, you know, who did what, but I know that that's a big problem. And it starts because in elementary school, if that foundation is not set, forget it. Because
I'm gonna stop right there because I know how extensively you can get into that. And before you do, I have to introduce my other panelist who's going to get it into it as extensively as you can. So I can tell you that this hour is going to go really quickly. I can tell right now. But hold on for a second. I think you all will be familiar with my next guest because he every once in a while has called in, but he has been on other panels. He is a Broadway performer. He is an actor. He is a director. He is a writer currently living in the borough of Brooklyn. He has said to me that he's been recently named Marquee in the Marquee Who's Who in America. And he followed in the footsteps of his mother, who was named in the Who's Who in American Education. So education was a lineage in his family. It's a very important element of development, one of the things that was expected. But let's go on to all the other things that he's done. He's been on Broadway in the Big River. He's been off Broadway and in a number of theaters and like La Mama, like Soho Rep, the New Media Rep. He has played Othello. Now, that's the other thing. His classical training is I don't say it's unique, but it does put him in another category that is not often shared with a lot of people who have done musicals as well as done the classics. So he has done that. He's done a number of classical works like The Winter's Tale, Comedy of Errors, Hamlet, Romeo and Juliet, a lot of that. Mostly I'd like to say that his education occurred in the Maryland, Washington, D.C. area, and then he attended Texas Christian University, where he's gotten his Master of Fine Arts, and then he received his Master of Fine Arts from the University of Delaware. He also was on a scholar, Diana Sands scholarship from a Circle Square. So with all of those things, again, you will see that both of my guests are overqualified for anything that I have to talk about in education because it's just a wish list for me. They've actually done it. I want to introduce you to my other guest who's in the panel, and that is Franz Jones. Franz, please say hello.
Good evening. How are you? How is everyone? You forgot to say that I am also associate director of your company, Essence of Acting, Inc.org.
Yes. Well, you know, I shy away of saying too much about all the things that I do in the association. But yes, I did forget to say that because you are quite a wonderful asset to EOA, and Diane also has been in attendance to many of our events and celebrations.
Absolutely.
So I don't promote it here because I don't want it to be misunderstood that this is a vehicle to do that. But though there are people who can research it and realize and see the participation. Yes. So now that I have said what my premise is and what prompted me to have this conversation, and indeed it's just a conversation because I just want to understand. I know Diane was talking about the foundation of all of it starts with what happens at home, because our primary years, our fundamental years, our developmental years are really exercised before we come to school. So our personalities are really formed in a way before we get there. It's influenced by all the other things that we come in contact with. But Diane, you were saying that the influence of the family, and you said something about missed opportunities. Go back and explain to me what you mean by that.
Well, the missed opportunities, well, it happens at home, but usually the parents, the home situation can be a lot of the times can be chaotic to the point where the child, even though they're in school, you know, the weight that everybody puts the weight on the teacher. And yes, we are teaching, but if we don't have the parent in the mix, it really doesn't work. You know, I've been retired 2 years and there's one parent. She's a little rough around the edges, but I love her for even contacting me now when she has issues with her kids. You know, she reaches out and I am there for people, even though I'm retired. You know, some take advantage, most don't. You know, and I don't know whether it's an embarrassment, but it is what it is. And I've told my parents, if you're not good, then my kids can't be good. And, you know, easier said than done for them. So, but then it just gets worse because the missed opportunities also happen in school because there are just too many things going on that have nothing to do with the education of the child. And the worst for me is let's make our school look the greatest ever. The focus should just be working, taking ideas from people. A lot of the administrators, most of the administrators that I've had are, their egos get in the way. They say things like, it's my school. No, it's the children's school. And the parents, you know, they can be moved out. And so everybody's trying to impress the higher-ups. I never had that bug. You know, I just do what I do. You know, but that's where the anxiety, once that sets in, it's a done deal. The kids, I was starting to say there was a school that was the worst. I couldn't believe that this school was only K-2. That's unheard of. So I just kept hearing people say, She's got to be connected, this principal, because she bypassed third grade. And it was probably, you know, designed that way for her. But what she missed out on, which was good for her, bad for the kids, bad for the next school. It's third grade when you take your first state test. So she didn't have to worry about whether or not they were any good, because the school that got them after they graduated with us in second grade had the burden. So here's the extra burden. If they weren't taught properly, K-1 and 2, guess what? You can't just go in and say, I'm going to teach third grade. They're here now, and we're going to start them where our school starts. If the kids don't have the experience from kindergarten at first, everything is linked. You learn certain things in kindergarten that prepare you for the work in first and so on. So that's where it really falls apart.
I have a question because the reason why, and thank you for being specific about all of that, the reason why I brought this subject up is that it occurs to me, and Franz, I want to ask you, that there has been a specific change in how the teachers view a teaching moment. Now your teaching experience was in Cornell, Franz?
Yes, I taught at Cornell, and I also participated in summers. I had a good friend who had a theater company, and he got monies from the state of New York to have summer programs teaching in the arts, and I would teach the drama part for his students. It was a dance company mainly. But I taught the drama part for them as well, and these were teenagers. But
right.
Yes.
So what my question to both of you, what my question then is, you know, I mean, and I know your experience, we're talking from the point of view of the student at this point, but my question, which prompted me to do all of this, was what has happened to make social media a teaching tool that the teachers think that it's a teaching tool for the students as opposed to the actually going up participating in conversation with the student. And in this in this particular case, it was asked, did you ever ask the students why they were cheating? Did you ever ask the students if they needed help? What, you know, and that was never done. So I'm asking you both because, yes, your experience is with the students, but your experience is also with the teachers. What has happened with the curve as to the concern of the teachers? Have they been preoccupied with the outcome of the passing grades, the tests, and so that there's an insensitivity about how the children are, the methodology in which the children are learning? Diane?
That's exactly it. Yes, everybody, they're fearful. And unlike artists who know that you know, the show must go on, when things happen and shakes and rattles the whole setup, the teachers freak out because they're not, I always say, I mean, other people, you don't have to be an artist to teach, but it helps because we don't panic. We don't panic like that. The teachers panic. They also are so fearful of the higher-ups. And they used to say, there was a saying, I don't know if you've heard this, Bronze, but they say that once, you know, you get behind the closed doors, you do what you want to do that you know has worked. You know, why reinvent kind of thing. Some of these teachers have, they can't even do that. Like they were a part of this broken system as well. But that's what
I
saw,
think,
people, you know, fearing.
I want to go back a couple of steps because one of the things that I've noticed, and my mother talked a lot about this years ago, is the fact that back in the day, so to speak, teaching was a profession. People that became teachers, that's what they wanted to do. They studied that. They went to school, and they wanted to be teachers. Nowadays, and I think, Lenny, you've talked about this in the past, teaching became something that people wanted to do in the meantime. Maybe
in
they
the
wanted
meantime,
to be on Wall Street. Yeah, they wanted to be on Wall Street, or they wanted to be on Broadway, or they wanted to work on cruise ships or something. So because they couldn't get that position first, or because they needed to do something to help pay off their student debt, they would go and get teaching jobs because teachers were always in demand, especially in public schools. And you had a lot of people that came into the teaching profession that didn't see it that way. They saw it as just another job. So they would take the book and kind of teach the book, or in some cases, I've heard this a great deal, teach the test. They would teach the standardized test that the states require. And that's basically what it was about for them. So the idea of learning for the student was kind of lost in the shuffle because you had teachers that weren't committed to teaching children and giving children their expertise, giving children their knowledge that will help them to go forward in life. And so it became something that was passed down generationally because you would have a lot of young people who would then have children of their own. They weren't taught, so they didn't have any respect for teaching themselves. So their children were kind of dumped into a school situation. They were already coming in with a certain amount of, They were resentful of teachers. When teachers would come to them and say, well, listen, I need to speak to you about Johnny or to Jane about what they're doing or what they're not getting, the parents were already wanting to fight with the teacher and not be an assistant to the teacher. They wanted to always be against the teacher. And that's something that I've noticed. And that goes all the way from public school into college as well. My experience at Cornell, it's very interesting. They gave us a syllabus, and we had to teach by the syllabus. This is the college level. And we're teaching artists. We were teaching drama. You would think that that would allow us to be able to open the students' minds and do certain things with plays that aren't normally done in the mainstream. I give you a good example. My colleagues and I, we got together and we wanted to do a production of Romeo and Juliet. We were going to have a white man and a white family, the white people play play Romeo's family, the Montagues. And we had a young black lady who was going to play Capulet, and all the Capulets were black. And Cornell did not want us to do it. Not only that, but the girl that was to play Juliet was an extremely dark-skinned girl with short, kinky hair. And they were horrified. They fought us every step of the way. So we ended up having to do it as a studio production. And they discouraged the other students from coming to see it. Yeah, it's that kind of...
As opposed to the main stage?
As opposed to being something on the main stage, right, yes. This is the kind of thing that went on. I did, in classroom, we had to teach certain plays. Some of the plays that were on the syllabus were plays that had not been performed anywhere easily in over 50, 60 years. I remember one of them was Waiting for Lefty, which is from the 1930s. It deals with the communist thing. I mean, there are other plays that you can do that also deal with it that are more recent and more accessible for today's students. And I asked the head of the department, can I do something else with this rather than do Waiting for Lefty? You know, Waiting for Lefty is there. That's what you're going to do. So I said, okay. So I tried to work with it in different ways, and that made me kind of an enemy of the head of the department. For example, one of the plays that we could teach was Fences. Now, I didn't have a lot of black kids in my class, so I really couldn't do Fences the way that Fences would normally be done. So I had a guy who was from the Bronx, and I had a young lady who was from Brooklyn, and I cast them as Troy and Rose. And I had them do the scene where Rose confronts her husband about his affair. I took out the N-word. I took out references to color and just had them play it. And I remember in the beginning, the girl that played from Brooklyn that played Rose said, "Troy, I want to talk to you," which is exactly, that's how it's written. So they played that scene and it worked. And he wasn't very happy about it at all. He said, "Well, this isn't what I want to do." And I said, "But it's opening their minds just to understand that if plays are universal, then anyone should be able to do it. And it should be something that can be taught. So that way students will understand and they can go to the theater and they can see Fences and understand that it does relate to them. Or they can go and see something else that, again, can relate to their experience. But too often people are put in boxes and kind of left there, and students aren't given the opportunity to kind of grow because they're only taught certain things and that's it. They limit what can be taught by teachers. And again, some teachers who just want to have a job, so they're not interested in trying to expand. Yeah, and I know you know that, Diane.
I had a rough time because I went against that. I did the same kinds of things you're talking about. There was a Columbia Teachers College program that all the English language arts teachers hated, but they would only say it on their way out to the bathroom during a workshop break. They would never confront, and these people were really close to the principal. I would think if, you know, she listened to me a little bit, but she would certainly listen to them, but I don't know who was, there was one AP that was pushing it. That's the problem. When you don't see, not everyone learns the same way. You know, the Howard Gardner, I don't know if you're familiar, Franz, with, but he has these seven principles of learning. And it works. He says if you are a reader, if you see your kid likes to read, you know, a lot and always wants to speak, you let them take on that role. You know, and there's room for everybody to grow that way. Kids who are introverted, you know, the ones who can't sit still. I had something for everyone, and a lot of teachers, some do it. But you're right. The bigger problem is that they don't care. See, I'm saying that a lot of times they're not creative, but they wouldn't try anyway. I know some people who are there for the paycheck waiting for the next gig. The gig never came, so they never left. And the kids are being cheated.
Right.
Yeah, the teachers are there for the summers off. You forgot that one. The summers off.
Oh, yeah. That's right, for summers off. Exactly right.
Let me Let me ask you. So what we're saying now is that we're in a system that used to be a system where people grew up wanting to be teachers. It was like a calling.
It's not a calling now.
No, it definitely is not a calling any longer.
And tell me if I'm incorrect or not. There are portions in this country that say that they will accept substitute teachers that that don't have any college degrees, allow experience in the classroom, and then after that experience, they will submit them as full blown teachers. What is your opinion about that?
I think it's horrifying. I know that Arizona does it. I believe Texas does too, maybe. Some states have done it for years anyway. I do know that years ago, Kentucky, I think Tennessee, and maybe Texas then as well. It used to be back in the days of the one-room schoolhouse that sometimes the highest graded student would end up being a teacher for the younger children. In a one-room schoolhouse, that might be something that could work because if a young lady, for example, is maybe 18 years old and she's gone through all the way up to 12, she can probably help in teaching K-1 and maybe 2, but not to do the entire range. And to go and teach in a high school or a junior high school or middle school for someone that doesn't have a teaching degree, that has not actually studied teaching, the methodology of teaching, I think it's a horrifying thing. It's one of those things that's happening nowadays because we live in this world with social media and that sort of thing. So we have people who have followers and have a high presence on social media. So they're able to access certain skills and certain jobs based on that. So it becomes a thing that I think, for example, in Arizona, what I read was because there are not that many teachers any longer, they use these people because they figure that these people with their high visibility can point out things for students to possibly learn. I don't know how, but this was something that I read. Yeah.
They're grasping at straws. You know what's even worse for me? Mm-hmm. The principals there, I don't know if you remember this, Ron, but back in the day, when you taught and you were a new teacher or even someone who's been teaching for a while, principals used to model. They knew enough about a little bit of this, a little bit. They would model what they wanted to see. That has gone out of the window. Nobody modeled. They would model for the teacher. They would come in, take over the class for a minute or two and show the teacher how it should be done.
Absolutely.
Many of the principals now can't even do that. And there's what is the program? There's a program that I can't think of the name of it now, but there's a program that's up and it's been up for years where there's a different way people can slide into a teaching thing. That was part of the downfall, you know, where you got a lot of people who were not buying in and they didn't have that passion. They would bypass certain things. And we have a lot of those teachers now. The teacher, so I forget the name of it, but the fellows.
The fellows, but it used to be a thing too, as you speak of principals. My mother started as a teacher. She went from being a teacher to being a counselor, from being a counselor to being an assistant principal, to finally being a principal, to eventually becoming what she ended up being, the associate director for Women and Minority Affairs for AASA, which is the American Association of School Administrators. But she climbed a ladder to get there. There's no ladder. Yeah. You've got people that are principals that have never taught.
Yes. Or they taught for a hot minute and they were so horrible.
Yes.
I worked with two. They were so horrible. I'm saying, oh my, can I say that word again? It's so awful that they left because they knew they couldn't handle the class. They can't handle more than 10 kids. The woman that I was talking about actually was the one that only had K through two. She really screwed up the schools. Everybody in the neighborhood, the schools, hated her, the administrators and the teachers, because she did not prepare them for third grade. So during third grade now, they're in another school, and they have to reteach second grade curriculum before they can start third grade, and the kids have to take a spring state test. The pressure, and that's another reason. If the teachers aren't creative, you know, they can't even, and they shouldn't have to be that creative, but that's what's going on now.
What I'm hearing then is with all of that, because I'm going to keep going back to the social media thing, is that social media is taking the place of the teaching experience. You know, I mean, because that's what this young woman had decided. She said, you know, cheaters never win or something like that. So and we understand that that's not a practice that we want to encourage, but we also know that the circumstances in which you give a lesson to a child is it's very important that you know how to execute that, because you could damage that child for the rest of their life.
Yeah, and that's what happened. I've seen it happen. I saw a kid in kindergarten who was bubbly. They brought me out of my class. Somebody covered for a minute so I could see this kid in the office. She was bubbly. She was theatrical. And at 1 year, they destroyed her. The body language changed. A lot of these people are not even in tune to the body language changing. And others who want the summers off and a job before they go and get their big Broadway thing, they don't even care. So they're not looking at that. That kid was destroyed. Hanging her head. Quiet.
All the practices before this, when education was a staple, when it was an advocation that people sales to, that was a goal. When you were a child, when I was a child, I was left-handed when I went to kindergarten. At the time I came to kindergarten, I was right-handed. Now I'm ambidextrous. Yeah. But that's because I forced myself to, because my father was left-handed, and I wear everything on as a tribute to him, because he's passed away. I wear everything that left-handed people do, like watches on the right side for me and everything like that. Because even when it was at its height, there were practices in schools that decided what children were going to be. You were going to be, they tried to stop my father from being left-handed, but it didn't work. His extensiveness in school wasn't consistent enough so that he would come back he had to do work on the property and everything, come back, he would still be left-handed. Well, mine was very consistent. You know, in an age when your child went to school every day and you encouraged 100% attendance. And my parents had, you know, they would take things out of my left hand and put it in my right hand. And I thought nothing of it.
I had that experience as well. You know, I tend to be more on the left. I was taught to write with my right hand. If you've ever watched me write, you can see that I really should have been left-handed, because I write very strangely, because I never was comfortable writing with my right hand. I remember telling my mother when we started to change from using pencils to pens, I had a really difficult time controlling my right hand pens. It was a different technique. I could do it with a pencil, but it was really hard, and I had to bear down in order to continue to write with my right hand.
Now, what was the purpose of that? I'm left-handed. I never had anyone try that.
Back in the day, there was a whole thing. I think that they thought that kids that were going to be left-handed were somehow going to be different in a way that would not conform.
The right person. I mean, I look at it, even when I do a lot of things physically, the first thing that people say is that they gear it to the right hand, because we're a society that our brain thinks that everything starts to the right. But when you think about the service, you start, your march starts on your left foot. That's the left
right,
foot.
That's true.
Left,
that's
right,
your,
left
your left foot.
Which is
very,
no,
I'm stronger on the left side than I'm on the right side. I always have been.
Yeah. Well,
even
it's amazing how,
you know, I will do to the, I'm sure if my teacher's listening now, and I think she is, when I do exercises that we do, when I do them on tape, she'll start on the right. I'll start on the left because I want to be able to use that part of my body as a leader at the same time, so that it, that the right side isn't always the leading part, that I like starting with the left side. So that, and I can tell the difference, the strength of it is I'm more equally balanced. Like I'll do it 1 week and it's all right. And the next time I do it, when I start up, I do it all left. And it's an adjustment as I'm doing the workout. It acquires an adjustment in my brain to listen exactly what I was anticipate for the next thing to be on the, on the opposite side that I'm instructed. So it's a challenge. It's also a challenge of doing the brain. So I became very aware that most of the things in our society are geared to right-handed people because my father was left-handed. You know, and I can see
that it's been like that for years. No, it's interesting. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No. I have to say at this point in time, you know how me. We're down to the last 10 minutes. I have to say, because it goes very quickly.
I wanted, but I did want to make a point before it goes about schools in terms of public schools versus these charter schools. My mother fought really hard to keep public education public. That was one of the big things that she did, was to fight to keep it, because she recognized, and coming out of a time when there was segregation, and the three of us know, probably you guys less than I do because you grew up in New York, which wasn't technically segregated. When I grew up in Washington, literally it was. Even though Brown versus Board of Education was 54, the practice of it didn't really start to happen until later in the 50s. When I was in junior high school and high school in the 60s, in Washington, in Maryland rather, schools were still segregated. The junior high school I attended, all of the kids in Prince George's County had to get on buses to come to the junior high school that was near where I lived, because they couldn't go to the white schools out further in the county. So this idea of charter schools was something that she fought, because she saw it as, again, kind of segregating and not allowing people to have universal education, that education wasn't going to be on a level for everyone to access. Very interesting.
Right.
But
people who go there see it.
Right. Earlier today, we just found out school down the street here is now a charter school. It's been a public school for years, but now they have thing as a charter school.
You know what they don't talk about? The fact that they throw out, because we've gotten many rejects from charter schools because that's what they call them. I mean, you know, it's a terrible thing.
Mm-hmm.
But they will, we've got a lot of kids who just couldn't conform. They are very hard. A lot of these charters are very hard on these kids, and they don't take into consideration. They're even worse, taking into consideration the personalities. And I want to know, where are the people who are, you know, thinking about the child's mental state? You know, I always say that when adults go to school, if you've had a bad night with your spouse or whatever, and you, sometimes you're out of it, they don't take that into consideration. It's like, get in here, learn this, because we got to get this over in this period. I can't tell you how many times I've hung over or seen my kids after at another time, because you've got to get that out of the way. If they don't have a foundation, they can't think. I've had kids who were punched in the face by their own parents. How are they going to think?
Oh, my
God.
Yeah.
How are you going to think?
I mean, we came out of a time in the 70s when the kids were going to school after mom and dad had been doing crack all night long. I mean, you know, that's the reality that they had.
But also, respond. You brought up the charter school versus the public school subject. And I think what I think a lot of people have to understand is how it's presented to the communities that it's presented to. A lot of these communities, it's the charter school is presented at most as a as an alternative to private school, where those people could not send their children to private school.
Right.
Now, I'm not saying proper representation, but I think that's why you have people doing it. They go, they're in a lot of the public schools. There are a lot of violent situations that happen, and people want to try to move their children away from it, and they think that this is an alternative that represents a similarity to a parochial or private school. It's not necessarily the same. There are a lot of conversations about both of them and how people, their pros and cons on it, but it's also how it's represented, especially in the communities of people of color as a form of...
Absolutely. I'm glad you said that.
Right.
Because that's a big part of it as well, because the beginnings of charter schools, if you remember,
there is an intent.
It came out of segregation because the white kids, when they had to go to schools with black children, the white parents didn't want their children to do that. So public schools became integrated. So white parents got together and would send their children to private schools. But as you know, private schools became very expensive. And
they called Virginia, they had a name for them, and there were so many of cathedrals. It started with a C. I don't remember what it is. But when we lived in Virginia, there were all these schools. And I thought, what are these schools? And they were the schools that were built in the 50s and 60s that were, it was the escape of the, decided that they were not going to integrate. They're not going to permit their children to be in a school that was integrated. And so they built these institutions and called them not cathedrals. It's another, but it starts with a C. And they were all over the place. They were all over
that's
the place.
That's the beginnings of charter schools. It's also when homeschooling suddenly became popular again. Homeschooling used to be because back in the olden days, mom and dad were on the farm, and in the middle of winter, kids went to school. But when it became time in the spring to plant and in fall to harvest, they needed the extra hands. So children were out in the summertime to help, but they still needed to be there in the fall. So kids could be home and taught by their parents for part of the year. But they went back and picked up some of that in order to allow some of these white students not to have to go to school with black kids or Asian kids or Hispanic children. And they said, well, I'm going to homeschool my child myself. And how much, I mean, yeah, you might be able to do it on a certain level, but you're also bringing up a child that's not socialized. This is not a child that knows how to deal with other children.
That's one of the comments that's made on a lot of the generations now, is the lack of socialization. And there are these schools where they have schools on homeschooling online, which means that your child, it's like a webinar.
Yeah.
You know, your child is in there with someone, but they're not actually making any social contact. So there is the usage of in-person contact is very important. Now, it also becomes a health issue because, you know, we're in a point in our history now and in our society where we have a lot of health issues that we're dealing with. And a lot of children are susceptible to that because we have more diseases now, especially the children are susceptible to than there were when I was younger. There's things now that they talk about the children have that they didn't exist. It wasn't that they hadn't.
No, but we grew up in one of the worst epidemics of history, and that was polio.
Polio.
Right.
Polio was not, I mean, their polio vaccine was not available until the early 60s. So some of us who went to elementary school in the 50s and remember well, you would come back in the fall And certain children wouldn't be there because over the summertime they got sick and got polio. I was a part of the control groups because in Washington, they tested us all the time with every polio vaccine they came up with. And I can remember being in school and they would line us up and shoot us. And some children got
don't
something.
Say just
and
shoot,
you know,
tell them it was a needle shoot, not a shoot you.
Right. It was a needle. That's right. They shot you with a needle. And I remember some kids didn't come back to school. And I always came back. So whatever they gave me must have worked. I don't know. But, yeah, we were a part of that group. And every year, it was always the fear of polio.
Well,
some kids went
now,
to camp. I never went to camp.
I have to culminate this with saying that we have to integrate the arts into this. And one of the things that Diane was saying and said is that, you know, there are people who are artists who have a tendency to have a little bit more sensitivity to it because of the simple fact of what we do for a living, and it also our lifestyle makes us more flexible.
Right.
We have a little patience with things. We understand it's not everything is not black and white. And so the integration of the arts into the education system is not as impactful as it could be when you have people who do not have that as a background. It's not that everyone has to, but most of the teachers that I know who have been on this panel, they have artistic backgrounds. They've been dancers. They've been singers. They've been, you know, actors. They've been into the artistic world, and that has given them a whole way of looking at the universe and looking at the students that they have in their classroom and resolving some of the issues that. And I think that's where the arts, I think, become very, very important to this.
Absolutely. The problem with that, Lenny, is that they don't want us to take over because then we look like we can fix it. But we can. I was in a school where we were paired off. I was paired off with a math teacher. Another teacher was paired with science. And we made it happen. I created this crazy thing to teach fractions. I called it like nursery something frenzy of whatever. But it was nursery rhymes. And it would be like Jack and Jill went up the hill with the pail, but then I would turn it into fractions. The kids bought into it totally. The science teacher did the same thing. He was an actor who did plays. He turned the science, you know, he wrote things about, you know, shows that he created that taught the science. So there's creativity out there. It's just the administrators and the powers that be want to think they're highbrow and you know more because you teach math and you teach ELA and you know. And so they won't even let us touch it.
And the arts are always the first thing that gets cut. Whenever
something is
cut out of a budget for education, the first thing to go are the arts, always.
Yes. Now I have to say that we are down with less than 3 minutes to go, and I have given the questions because. But if anyone has something at this point in time you want to press the number one, you can. The panelists are here to answer your questions. We've been very opinionated. You can tell that all of us are artists, and we have a concern for the future. Our students, whether they be scientists, whether they be corporate people, it doesn't matter. We just want them to learn with pleasure. We want them to learn with choices. And and it doesn't seem like that. The threat to it is more and more with the AI and everything else that is coming in to play. You know, it just gets to be less and less about the student and more about a methodology. And not trying to help. You know, again, like I said, I'll make this point about this, that all of the people around this young student were all adults, and not the mother, not the teacher, ever asked her what was the issue, what did you feel? And so finally the judge said, well, why? She said, well, I feel pressure from everybody. everybody. I mean, I had to go to school, and then if I failed, you know, I failed my family, and then you know, they didn't understand it was difficult for me, and, you know, and they were spending this money, and they told me that they were spending. All of these pressures that our students are being, as you say, Diane, put on, and it doesn't matter. You can come from a privileged family, or you can come from a family where your child has just been punched in the face, and that happens in all kinds of levels also. The pressure is there, and we have to learn to ease up on it, because we're not allowing I think our children to be children anymore. And they had the square of the Lodi square, and they said who remembers this as a game, and I had to say yes. I mean, my knees used to be so, my mother was so upset with me because they'd be dark and being on the concrete of playing Lodies with a soda top, you know, and knowing how to do that.
that's funny.
Go ahead. No, the other thing that we didn't really speak about, the special needs. Do you know how many students are classified as special needs, and it's only the anxiety because nobody's talking to them? It's so sad, especially boys. You know, and that's another issue.
That's a whole other issue. Yeah, I mean,
We'll touch on that in the webinar, because we are now have to come to the end of this episode so that you all can get ready for the webinar. The link to the webinar is on our Facebook page, and everyone, if anyone wants to join us there, they are welcome to it. This is the visual part of this program, so you can see the people who have been talking this whole hour about our concerns in the education system and the arts and all of that. So please go to the Facebook page and Lenny Godfrey, and it is, it's on there so that you can join the webinar and you can become an attendant to that. I want to thank my guest, Diane Wilson. I want to thank my guest, Franz Jones. I want to thank all of you who are on the board and all the listening that you all have done this, you know, so carefully this evening. We will be back next week. I am not, I'm on hold for two different things, so I'm not at liberty to say specifically, but please look at Facebook and I'll tell you what my guest will be next week. But it will be Wednesday, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, blogtalkradio.com/EzisandSam, F is in Fred, T is in Tom, H is in Harry, and the number 2. All of that said, thank you both of you so very much, and I'll see you on the webinar. If you have any issues, give me a text me and let me know, and we'll fix it, and we'll start the webinar as close to 8 o'clock as we possibly can. All right.
Okay.
Thank you, everyone, for listening to Lenny Godfrey Straight No Chaser. Thank you, Diane. Thank you, Franz. Say good night.
Good night.
Thank you, Lenny.
Thanks, Lenny.
Everybody's got the fever. This is something we all know. Fever isn't such a new thing. Fever started long ago. Never know how much I love you. You never know how much I care. When you put your arms around me, I get a feeling that's too hard to bear. You give me fever. When you kiss me, fever. When you hold me tight, fever. In the morning, fever all through the night. Listen to me, baby. Hear every word I say. No one can love you the way I do, 'cause they don't know how to love you far away. You give me fever. When you kiss me, fever, when you hold me tight, fever. In the morning, fever all through the night.